Coming up on Boston Public Radio, this has been a big week for mayoral forums, from the state of our schools to the future of the arts and culture scene. We'll check in with David Bernstein and Jared Bowen on where the candidates come down on these issues. From the mayoral race, it's on to the issue of race in America. Tufts University is taking on this complex topic with a national dialogue on race, covering everything from Trayvon Martin to the legacy of Martin Luther King. The question is, can a big conversation help to make sense of this colossal issue? And it's not a Thursday without Christopher Lydon behind the mic. He joins us for a forensic look at President Obama's foreign policy. Is this the man supporters voted for? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Peter Katsas and I are filling in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Peter Katsas.
Hey, Callie. We've got a big day.
We do. This week has been packed with mayoral forums. The most recent one happened last night. 11 mayoral candidates pitched their ideas on overhauling the school system. And our colleague David Bernstein moderated the event. David.
Well, good morning or good noon, I guess. How are you? Yes, I moderated 11 of them there, so I was a little busy.
You were the man, so
you live to tell about it too.
Yeah, exactly. Who do you think successfully came across as the next education mayor?
Oh, I don't know about that. I was going to say that that I survived it, but tougher to survive it were a couple of the candidates who were in a room full of teachers union folks talking about the need for more charter schools. So there were. John Connolly, Marty Walsh, and a couple others, Tom Barrows, Bill Walczak to a lesser extent, were a little bit put with their back to the wall, I think, in terms of how they were defending the reforms that they see coming. But very popular in the room were Felix Arroyo, Rob Consalvo, and Mike Ross, who were really throwing the red meat to those teachers. In terms of putting down the charter schools to some degree and really praising the teachers and talking about the need to give more resources to those teachers in their schools.
Hey, David, let's hear from Mike Ross from last night.
This entire debate about charter schools and about public schools for the last 5 months, I think has been a false debate. It's been an either-or.
Now, he said that, as you said, it was red meat. You, in fact, had described the whole event or the conversation about charter schools as a toxic one.
Well, I think I was a little bit taken out of context there because I was actually making a joke because it had been referred to by a couple of the candidates as a toxic debate.
So Consalvo in particular.
Yes, absolutely. So I was sort of making a crack about that. I want to take a little issue with what Mike Ross said there, and I think he was doing some posturing there in the room. It's true that a lot of the debate about charter schools has been very either-or, and I was asking them, I went right beyond that. In fact, the very first thing I did was ask for a show of hands, how many of you would agree with the statement that, on balance, charter schools have had an overall positive effect on the education of Boston's children? They all raised their hand for that. So I took it as a given that charter schools are, will be, and should be part of the equation. And I was asking them and trying to prod them on how you make it happen well, in-district charters should be there in addition to the Commonwealth charter schools.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you, but haven't charter schools become a symbol? You know, they're the symbolic club that City Hall and the school department, the school committee will use to try to beat concessions out of the teachers union. Am I being too harsh in saying that?
No, I think that that's I think that that's fair. And in fact, you know, really the argument for charter schools from the beginning has largely been that you need competition with the public schools to drive the public schools to do better. You know, and really part of that, I think, is, you know, implicitly to force concessions from the teachers' unions to allow, you know, certain things to be done in the classroom, like, you know, longer school days, you know, more hours, different types of ways of doing assessments and running classrooms and all those kinds of things.
See, is someone who has two boys still in Boston public schools, and, you know, my oldest boy has already graduated, I share the frustration of people who get, you know, so focused on charter schools. I think they're here. I think they're good. And frankly, while I do think teachers need to be fairly compensated for a longer day, the teachers union strikes me as a parent of they're bargaining. They have bargained with the city most recently as if this was 20 years ago. The city doesn't have the money it used to have. Did any of that come out yesterday?
Well, we did talk about the most recent contract that you're talking about, and John Conley was the only member of the city council who had voted against the adoption of that, the approval of that negotiated contract. And I put it to the rest of the candidates who were not on the city council whether they would have voted for it or not, and they all pretty much said that they would have voted in favor of it, that they accepted the negotiation.
Well, how lonely a place has this been for John Conley? Now, listen, I know the flip side of my question is this is what's powering his run for Boston.
That's right.
But how lonely a camper did he seem last night?
You know, I don't think, you know, he certainly is sort of, he has become, in a way, a symbol of the education reform movement that the union is very skeptical about, to say the least. But I, you know, when you dig beyond that, you know, and the fact that, frankly, I think that he uses that to a certain degree as a political tool, you know, he creates that image for himself to great effect. When you dig beyond that, there's a fair amount of agreement about a lot of different things. John Barros, former member of the school committee, he is not demonized so much by the teachers' union, although they're not necessarily putting him in their top tier. But he talks about integrating the charter schools and doing more reforms. And you had a number of the candidates who were very much in favor of extended learning hours, sometimes with caveats attached to that. You know, frankly, some of this is very difficult to pick apart because it is campaigning, and you have candidates who want to promise the world to everyone.
Listen, let me ask you about Rob Consalvo.
Yeah.
Consalvo, you know, in the press reports anyway, came across as someone who was trying to be a peacemaker.
And before you answer, David, we got a clip of Rob Consalvo from last night. So let's hear that.
When I'm mayor, I will negotiate contracts with the teachers union, and we'll do it together. We'll work together, and we'll get a negotiation that's in the best interest of the Boston Public Schools and in the interest of the teachers union, because that's the whole point of collective bargaining.
Notice he doesn't mention students.
You know, Consalvo released a lengthy document today on his plan for the Boston Public Schools, and my first read on it is that it's very vague and full of a lot of, you know, sort of vague promises and political speak, but not a lot about the costs or the difficulties in implementing them. He was really throwing red meat to a large degree at those teachers. You know, he is someone who really would have had a real chance to get their endorsement, and I think really wanted their endorsement. It sounds like they're not going to make one until after the preliminary, the teachers union. But he really wants those teachers' votes.
How strong a force in Boston politics are the teachers' union? You know, how many votes do they command?
You know, what I would say is that supposedly there are about 5,000 members of the union who live in the city. So that's a, when you're talking about, it might only take 25,000 votes or so to get into the final. That's a pretty big chunk. But what the real value of the teachers' union can be is if they decide to endorse and really put some force behind it. You know, they can do a lot of door to door. They can send out mailers.
And David, we should mention that they have said they're not endorsing until after the preliminary. So
right.
That means that nobody gets their door to door or their support until the 24th or after the 24th.
And they made that announcement, at least Richard Stuttman there had seemed to say that to a couple of reporters after the debate. Going into last night, they were saying it's unlikely but still possible. And so I think that Rob Gonsalvo, Mike Ross, maybe a couple others were hoping to get something across that would get that endorsement. But it seems clear that it's not going to happen.
The failure of the teachers union to endorse going into the preliminary makes it more likely that the three front runners, DA Dan Connally, Boston City Councilor John Connally, and State Senator Marty Walsh of Dorchester, will still remain the three front runners. Isn't that true?
Yeah,
or am I off base?
No, I think that that's right. I think that, and in a way, it may seem sort of self-defeating for the teachers union because they're not entirely thrilled with all three. They, obviously Marty Walsh is well liked among unions, but he's on the board of a charter school, and they're not so thrilled about that. Obviously, John Connally, they don't like. Dan Connally is very big on charter schools and some other reforms. There was a real possibility that an endorsement of a Rob Gonsalvo or a Charlotte Golar Ritchie or a Mike Ross could help elevate one of them up into that top tier and give the teachers union someone they really liked final.
Let me ask you about Golar Ritchie. Her campaign got off to a slow start, but in recent weeks, she seems to be picking up steam. How was she last night? Was she convincing? Was she articulate? Was she forceful?
I would say she was fairly forceful. She made some, pretty passionate statements about her feelings about the schools. I don't think that she comes across as forceful or convincing from that perspective as a Felix Arroyo, for instance, who's very passionate speaking about the schools, and a couple of others. And frankly, she got muddled down again trying to explain her sort of if-then kind of position on lifting charter school caps in the city. And I did not find her terribly convincing, but sometimes as the moderator, you're a little busy with
and
you don't have the right impression that
David,
others do.
David, there's more to the Boston Public Schools than charter schools. Did anything else, did they talk about the need to empower principals or recruit a diverse teaching body? Did anything else get discussed there? I mean, I was following it on Twitter, and it was sort of, the charter schools seemed to dominate, but there were hints that something else.
And let me add to that and say that you mentioned Felix Arroyo and his passion about this issue, and he did speak up and speak about other issues with regard to parents and their involvement. Let's take a listen.
Third shift workers who are working their second and third job, you're going to have a real difficult time getting them to come to a parent-teacher meeting because they have to work a third shift job to provide for their family.
Felix is always soulful.
and he's very convincing. He's certainly well-liked in the room. The truth is that the charter school discussion was really the first round. We only had, I believe, four rounds altogether, but we did end up spending that whole round on different aspects of the charter schools, but we talked about a lot of other things. We talked a lot about standardized testing, with almost all of the candidates agreeing that there's too much emphasis currently on standardized testing and too much standardized testing now, and a lot of discussion about what to do about that, what you can change, but what you need to leave in place. We did have a fair amount of discussion about how to increase parental involvement and also, one thing I was trying to push them on, we talked about a lot of different things, you know, the need to improve the schools, the school facilities, the need to have more teacher and principal training, and a lot of individual good ideas on all these different pieces. And I was trying to push them on sort of prioritizing, you know, these things cost resources. Resources are limited. Where would you prioritize them? And I think by the end, I was able to get them a little bit to say, you know, if there's only limited amounts, you know, this candidate would put it more towards, you know, improving supplies. This one would go more towards training teachers. This one would go more towards the buildings and so forth. So I think we've drew out some differences there.
Final question from me, David, and that is, we are having so many single issue forums that by all accounts are extremely well attended, even though the numbers suggest that people aren't paying attention. Where would you put the interest in this particular subject, education, public schools, charter schools, and all the rest, in the context or on the spectrum of all the some of the other issues that have also been discussed?
Well, I think this has to be one of the top ones. You know, I mean, almost everybody in the city has some interest in this topic, and many people have a very, very high interest in the topic. And it's also one that people have very different points of view on. So so I think it is one of the biggest. I think that when you talk about these sort of single interest or narrow focused forums, which I've been to several of just recently, you do get a high audience, but they're a very engaged audience. I think most of them, their mind isn't made up. They're down to one or two people, but they certainly know what they think on those on that particular issue. I don't know that we're seeing sort of the regular neighborhood, you know, sort of walk-in type people, as opposed to sort of the thought leaders in that particular topic.
All right. Well, we'll see if the interest gets pumped up as we get closer to September the 24th. David Bernstein, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
David Bernstein is a contributing editor to Boston Magazine and, most importantly, a political analyst here at WGBH. So, what do we talk about when we talk about race? Tufts Professor Peniel Joseph has some ideas on how to get at this complex issue. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley, here with Peter Katsas. We are sitting in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Now, usually it takes a big event like the fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin or the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington to get a conversation on race going. But once the conversation starts, what does it take for it to be productive? Here with us in Studio 3 to get at this question is Peniel Joseph. He's a history professor at Tufts and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Tonight at 7, he's hosting National Dialogue on Race Day. Welcome back, Peniel.
Thank you for having me.
We're opening up the lines at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What is your take on this? What kinds of conversation about race are you having? And can you have an honest conversation with your friends, with your family? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. So, Peniel, this was inspired by the Trayvon Martin, all the dialogue, informal around that case?
Yeah, this Trayvon Martin was a big part of the inspiration and really the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, because the way in which I conceive of the March on Washington is that whether Dr. King said it or not or intended it to be or not, that march and that speech starts a national conversation about race and democracy in America. And really, when we think about August 28th, 1963, up until January of 1977, there's a national conversation on race and democracy in America. And the reason I say this is that January of 1977, the concluding part of that 14-year arc, is actually when Roots premieres on ABC. And over 7 nights, there's over 110 million Americans who watch Roots, the most watched miniseries of all time in American history.
Which tells the story of slavery in the United States.
Exactly, which tells the story, Kunta Kinte, which tells the story of slavery in the United States, written by Alex Haley. And so when we think about Dr. King in 1963, for the next 14 years, everyone's talking about race, whether it's the New York Times, whether it's television shows, whether it's news programs. People are talking about affirmative action. They're talking about racial justice, racial equality. How do we move towards racial integration? And sort of Roots becomes the high point of that. And afterwards, really in the ensuing decades, we've moved away from having that honest, open dialogue about race. And in fact, we've embraced racial denial, saying that if we just think of everybody as colorblind, we won't have any trouble. But the problem with colorblind racism is that it assumes equality as a fact, but it doesn't care about racial outcomes and the disparities and the inequalities that surround us.
All right. Now, you wrote in The Root, which is an online news website, that dialogue should be led by activists, civil rights organizers, policy experts, and community leaders for the express purpose of crafting public policy solutions connected to issues of racial disparities and criminal justice, employment, public schools, housing, health care, and overall life chances in America. And that's very valid. I happen to know that Peter Katzis and I are on the same page about this. We believe in the small conversations and the kind of the one-on-ones that are very difficult to have, of course, but you know, that's where it starts. And it sometimes seems like a drop in the bucket. I'm not speaking for you, Peter Katzis. I'm going to let you speak. But it seems to get, you seem to get more from that.
A piece of background here. I think because I began as a newspaper reporter during the busing crisis, you know, that the older I get, the more I realize what a profound effect that had on me. I grew up in working class Dorchester, and I came not to recognize the city that I thought I knew. And I think that's one reason why I'm personally so suspicious of large conversations as opposed to micro conversations. I know right after the Trayvon Martin case came down, the verdict, at my church, at the coffee hour, someone raised the subject, and we had a spontaneous 20-minute, you know, 20, 30 people conversation that, you know, it didn't change the world. But when we all left that day, I can't speak for the other 29 people, but I had a sense that, you know, I had more thinking to do, and I had a sense of epiphany about how important these issues were. Am I talking craziness?
No, I think you're right. But I think one of the things that we're doing here at Tufts University and the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and we've been joined by other schools, Duke University, UCLA,
Arizona,
Fairfield, mm-hmm. Arizona State, mm-hmm. all these schools are joining us, is that dialogue is power. So that great conversation that you had in a coffee shop, imagine if there was 300 people there and people could actually interact with each other, but it was connected to public policy, and you're finding people being proactive instead of reactive, where we're coming together annually and having dialogues in between, including in the communities, places like Dorchester's, but places like South Boston as well, where we talk about race, public policy, democracy, employment, the criminal justice system. A byproduct of that is going to be those one-on-one conversations where you say you meet somebody who, even if you may perhaps disagree with, you can see their point of view, and it's bringing people together. So we feel that this dialogue is actually going to bring about a lot more intimacy across races right here in Boston. But our number one goal is that we're actually changing policy, that we're connecting policy experts, civil rights activists, and really allowing them to share resources and networks. We're going to bring people to Tufts tonight who've never been on a college campus, people who are from Dorchester, who are from Roxbury, community people who are activists and who can utilize the resources that we have, and we can help them in their promotion of social justice, their promotion of racial equality, provide information in a clearinghouse and in a headquarters for that, and to build that dialogue in Boston.
So you're saying both and?
Both and, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. Okay.
Exactly.
I think there was probably no more interest and conversation than back in 2008 when President Obama was running for office and he made what is now called the famous race speech. I wanted to play a piece of that, because what he's touching on in this in the part that we'll hear next is really how complex this discussion is.
But race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now. We would be making the same mistake that Reverend Wright made in his offending sermons about America, to simplify and stereotype and amplify the negative to the point that it distorts reality. The fact is that the comments that have been made and the issues that have surfaced over the last few weeks reflect the complexities of race in this country that we've never really worked through.
I really want to play another piece from that speech because he's just so we can get the full or a fuller understanding of what he meant by complexity.
I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love.
There, President Obama was referring to the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who he mentioned in the first part of the clip. And he's responding to some comments that some thought were volatile from Reverend Wright and talking about his own family and how one gets through this.
I remember I watched this speech and I listened to Pat Buchanan, a dyed-in-the-wool right-winger, give Obama a 10 out of 10 and say that, and he said he thought this was one of the most honest discussions in race in America that he had ever heard. I mean, which was quite a thing coming from Pat Buchanan.
Absolutely. So in this way, you know, there can be a kickoff, if you will, of the kind of conversation you're talking about.
No, absolutely. That race speech, March 18, 2008, not only saved that campaign, but really was one of the most honest and open dialogues about race and racism, precisely because the president said that, or then Senator Obama said that, look, racism is part of the founding of the republic. Race and democracy are intertwined in our history. There's no getting away from the fact that this is a republic that talks about freedom and democracy, but founded in racial slavery. And tonight, what we're trying to do is have a conversation that's open and honest, but that's one that's really led by activists and scholars and community organizers that connects race in a really, I think, in an optimistic way that says, where do we go from here 50 years after the March on Washington?
Let me introduce, if I may, the issue of economics. In thinking about this subject, it seems that during the golden age of the civil rights movement, the 50s, the early 60s, the American economy was expanding. Everyone was optimistic. I mean, that was the greatest economic boom in history. Today, we all know that the outlook is less optimistic.
Grim for some people.
Yeah, especially mm-hmm. if you're African American. Mm-hmm. But to what degree do you think economics is tamping down the enthusiasm for this discussion? Or maybe economics and race are two separate subjects. I see them as intertwined.
Well, they're absolutely intertwined. And I think the March on Washington, that subtitle was for jobs and freedom. So jobs and economic security were a big part of it. I think that in times of economic anxiety, and President Obama spoke about this a month ago, there tends to be more racial tension in times of economic anxiety historically. Competition over jobs between not just blacks and whites, but now immigrants who are in our country. So I think that the whole idea of racial justice also correlates with an expanding economic pie. One thing I would say is that there is an expanding economic pie, but that pie, that expansion is just going upwards in one direction north, and it's not leveling out to the middle.
The one percenters.
It's the one percenter. Mm-hmm. So the time you're talking about is 1945 to 1970, which is the largest economic expansion
Correct.
In American
yeah.
history. In the ensuing 43 years, what we've seen is a diminution of economic opportunity, especially for African Americans, especially for Latinos. We're going to talk about all that tonight. So you can't talk about the criminal justice system, what Michelle Alexander Twitter calls the new Jim Crow, without talking about the economy, without talking about poverty. One of the most disappointing aspects of President Obama, but we'll talk about this tonight, is that we don't hear words like poverty coming out of the President of the United States' mouth. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson launched a war on poverty as part of a great society. I argue that he would have never said those words without Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It's all connected.
I want to get some calls in here. John from Boston, go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One of the things that concerns me is the whole focus of the discussion all about African-American violence and white people conducting violence against African-Americans, where the media seems to downplay or ignore the multitude of examples of violence the other way. And you don't see Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson jumping up every time an incident occurs in which somebody that's not black is attacked and violently beaten, raped, or whatever. It's just an upsetting thing to think that the conversation always seems to be in one direction. And I think what people really need to do is stop asking for stuff and start doing stuff, lifting yourself up out of poverty and seeking economic fulfillment that way. I grew up in a poor environment. And I was able to do it. There's thousands of immigrants that come over here of all nationalities that seem to be able to do it. I don't know why the African-American community can't just focus inwardly and start pointing the finger and blaming other people for their troubles and just focus on fixing the solution themselves.
Okay, hold on. We're going to get Peniel Joseph to respond to you, John. And by the way, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Peniel.
Well, I think that historically, African-Americans have always been about political, economic self-determination. One of the problems has been, one, slavery, antebellum slavery up until 1865. And then for the next century, after the end of slavery, there was something called Jim Crow, or institutionalized racial segregation and discrimination. Now, it's not complaining to say that Jim Crow segregation, lynching occurred in the United States, including things like a convict lease system, which imprisoned and incarcerated and criminalized black men at the same time that it provided capital for private corporations and a tax base for local cities and municipalities. This was all unconstitutional and outrageous, and that's the burden of African-American history and the burden of American history. When the Voting Rights Act is passed August 6, 1965, and the Civil Rights Act is passed July 2, 1964, it's not a miracle day where immediately there's racial and economic equality. What African Americans face in the United States, and these are legislation that just got passed in the last 50 years, is trying to get a level of economic equality and racial justice after hundreds of years of institutionalized injustice, right? So it's not complaining to say that there's discrimination, that there's institutional racism, that there's a lack of voting rights, and that there has been systematic violence. And I can give you hundreds of examples.
Let me interrupt you, Peniel, and say some of what John has asked comes up often, because there's not a recognition of the difference between individual racism and what you have called systemic racism. Maybe just a little clarity around that would help put some context around what John has asked.
Well, personal prejudice is me saying that I don't like somebody who is of another race or ethnicity. Individual or systematic racism is the way in which institutions in the federal government can marginalize or oppress different groups based on their racial category. So when we think about what African Americans have faced, certainly they face individual prejudice, but what's more pernicious, what's more damaging, has been institutional racism. And in terms of a double standard about violence, I would actually disagree with that. I would say that historically what we've seen in the United States is that media has criminalized African Americans, especially black men, as pathologically violent and rapists, crack dealers, drug dealers, thugs. And we saw that criminalization in the Trayvon Martin case, where even a teenage boy who's unarmed and killed can be made to be a predator by the defense. And the jurors, at least some of the jurors, felt some empathy with Zimmerman, because they felt that Trayvon, if they had seen him, they would have been scared as well.
All right. Art from Worcester. Go ahead, please. You're on WGBH 89.7.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to say something, and I hope it doesn't offend anyone, because the intent is pure and simple. In the year 2000, the Human Genome Project didn't get enough publicity, as far as I'm concerned, but it proved that everyone on the planet is in a member of the human race, that race no longer can be used as the definition of one group or another. We all pass the test in that we can all interbreed. We are all of the same race. So I was proposing years ago, and I didn't, of course, get any traction, that make the United States a raceless country. And I know it'll take a while and transition, but I'd like to propose that maybe the President and Congress be given a referendum to remove the word race from our Constitution and any other legislation that exists. We have to be bringing ourselves that the idea of using this word race is only derogatory for anybody.
Art, you're breaking up a little bit, but your point is to get rid of the word race because scientifically we know that it's being used incorrectly, and you're absolutely right. However, in the United States, the race is used as a social construct, meaning that that is the way that certain kinds of oppressive policies and the kinds of things that Professor Peniel Joseph is talking about in terms of systemic discrimination have been articulated. That's how race is used in the United States. It's not used in the scientific way that it would be, someone like you who understands the broader context of it. So you're really dealing with what happens here socially when we talk
right.
about race, and that's how we have to
interact. I can remember during the busing crisis among polite white families, there was never nasty language used about blacks. It was always the element, you know, was it was certainly more polite, but the meaning was still very clear.
But one thing I'd say, the reason why we're convening this national dialogue on race day is that we have all these discussions about post-racial America.
Right.
And if Obama brought us to post-racial America, obviously that's not the case. But we should all be looking towards a post-racist America. And sometimes even my students ask me, well, Professor Joseph, how would that look? How does a post-racist society look? Well, the first indicator of a post-racist society that would be that whether you're African-Americans or Latinos or whites or Asian Americans, everybody relatively would fall into similar categories in terms of things like unemployment, in terms of things like education race, in terms of things like access to health care, right? In terms of incarceration, right? Because what we're saying is that just because of your race, you're not more likely to be violent or more likely to cause more crime just as some kind of genetic predisposition.
Scientifically.
Right.
Yes.
You mentioned incarceration. To me, the undeniable case for institutional racism still being extant is you look at the rate of African Americans incarcerated versus white kids. And now we all know a lot of this goes back to drug arrests. You can't tell me that drugs are not as rampant in the suburbs as they are in the inner city. And
at times even more so. I mean, you read The New Jim Crow, and that's the best-selling book by Michelle Alexander, and African-American rates of marijuana usage are four times less than their white counterparts, but they're arrested at a rate of two, three, four times more. Eric Holder, in his speech before the American Bar Association the Attorney General, he said that African-American males were being sentenced to 20% longer sentences for the same exact drug crimes. And so that's the Attorney General saying, look, one of the reasons the Justice Department is going to switch its philosophy, its crime-fighting philosophy vis-a-vis the war on drugs, has to do with institutionalized discrimination. So that is one of the areas that we need to look at. But in every single social economic indicator, African-Americans, Latinos are disproportionately overrepresented in terms of negative outcomes and underrepresented in terms of positive outcomes.
We're having a discussion with Peniel Joseph. He's a professor at Tufts and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. And tonight at 7, he's hosting National Dialogue on Race Day. It's also happening at other universities around the country. And right now, Dr. Joseph and Peter Katzis and I are continuing a conversation or that'll probably be broader and bigger, more contextual tonight. Let's take another call from Leah from Providence. And by the way, we're at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970 if you want to call in. Hi, Leah.
Hi, how you doing today?
Fine.
So here's my thought, okay? I work in higher education and nonprofits, and I've done a fair amount of work around social justice programming and helping to have these kinds of conversations on college campuses because they're so important. And I think the critical piece that I'm hearing that's missing from this conversation is really a conversation around white privilege. And this is so important. And as a white woman, I speak about this from kind of the trenches because this isn't something that I'm certainly an expert at, but it's something that needs to be given attention, particularly in student affairs programming and in, you know, more within the curricula as well. Because we don't talk about how being a poor white person is not the same thing as being a poor black person. And I think that speaks again to, you know, what you said earlier about, you know, economics and race are very closely intertwined, and they are. You know, being poor and white, there was a caller from Boston earlier who said, you know, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, you know, kind of figuratively, you know, pointing to this false meritocracy that I think he may believe still exists in the United States. I don't know if it's ever existed, frankly, but it's this dream.
Well, Leah, I think one of the issues is that when you talk about concepts of white privilege and then talk about race as a social construct and systemic racism, it's really hard for people to get their heads around. So let me suggest something that articulates white privilege in a way that everybody can understand. And that is a test called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. And this is by Peggy McIntosh. She spent a lot of time studying these issues. She asks a series of questions, and how you answer it will let you know where you are in terms of privilege. And that works whether you're a privileged black person or a privileged white person. But it's very clear once you answer those questions exactly what kind of invisible privileges exist every day for people who are not persons of color. Professor Joseph.
Well, I think you're right. I think we definitely have to have that conversation. I think that's part of the broader dialogue that we're going to be having tonight. So the idea of white skin privilege, especially in predominantly white settings like a place like Tufts University, we've never had this kind of dialogue that we're convening tonight. And if we're going to have racial justice and racial and economic equality in the United States, white people have to be part of that dialogue. At the same time, we have to have that dialogue in ways that is open enough that people who may not agree with our perspective want to be included in that dialogue. So I think the dialogue we're trying to create is one that creates, even if people are going to be challenged, it creates a safe enough space where everybody's opinion is actually going to be respected.
Peniel, let me play devil's advocate. How do you move conversations like this off the campus and into, say, a blue-collar community?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we're actually going to be trying to do. And part of it is getting community leaders to be part of that conversation. So we have Michael Curry, who's part of the president of the Boston NAACP. We have Paul Watanabe, who's a professor of Asian American history at UMass Boston. We have Diane McWhorter, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner for Carry Me Home. We have a number of different important people who are going to be there. Kim McLaren, who's one of the panelists for Basic Black, but a brilliant writer and professor at Emerson. So part of it is when we bring more people into this dialogue, we can actually follow up and do those things like going to a blue-collar community, but also going to Dorchester, Mattapan, Roxbury, Lowell, wherever we need to go. Because if we can have a dialogue in Boston, we can have it anywhere. And I think what's so important is to be inclusive enough where we can talk about racial injustice. We can talk about the need for a transformative democracy in the United States, but at the same time, bring people all to the table where we're not just doling out recriminations, where we're having an open, honest dialogue, but we're bringing people to the table.
You know, just one more point I wanted to say. No one holds it against Wall Street when they want to get their interests on the political agenda. Mm-hmm. Why is it that, you know, the interests of the African-American community, the Latino community, why is that special pleading when duly elected officials try to get those issues on the agenda.
Well, it's not special pleading, but it's definitely considered that because those groups don't have enough political and economic power to say that, look, this we're part of this pluralistic democracy. Here are our wants and needs, and we're going to negotiate to get as much as we can. So I completely agree with you. So part of what needs to happen is where so-called minority communities have enough leverage and power where their agenda is thought of as a positive part of the agenda. And we're seeing that with other groups, right? When we think about the president of the United States in his second inaugural address, talking about Stonewall and gay and lesbian issues that are certainly part of the movement for civil rights in the country, but have now been elevated. He talked about those issues and didn't really talk about African-American issues in his inauguration.
Let's take another call. Megan from Sharon, go ahead, please. You're on WGBH 89.7.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, I'd like to just thank Mr. Joseph for his eloquence and calm demeanor. When I hear people, like a couple callers back, somebody call and say, why can't African Americans just figure it out? And, you know, this is the, you know, we're in the 21st century. Why? It's like looking at slavery as a isolating just a past a piece of history that had no reverberations. It makes me crazy and angry. So I'm sorry that I'm not going to be very eloquent, but I'd like to say a couple of things. I'm earning a master's in applied linguistics at UMass Boston, and it would. You know, if I was calm enough, I would say, like, if everybody could take this program, then we would all have a place to, we'd have a dialogue about the politics of power where we're all learning about the truth and history because, of, you know, it's true that we, you know, at public schools, we're not taught to, you know, colonization is seen as a positive thing, first and foremost. The colonization brought all these wonderful things and languages to different parts of the world. You know, we don't educate honestly. And the applied linguistics program is wonderful because all it talks about is the politics of power and invisible privilege. And it just opens everybody's mind to who the dominant people are in society. We all hear, white men. But if you can hear the reasons why and actually see the facts, and then go from there. You don't just hear it as just some trite, expression that everybody's saying, oh, gosh, I'm so bad at this. And then the last thing, we had a big discussion about African-American vernacular English. I have friends on Facebook who posted Trayvon Martin's name. Trayvon Martin's, but the woman who stuck up for him and basically was on the phone with him the entire time.
Right, yeah, yeah. I think we get it, Megan, that you're very frustrated and nobody's listening and nobody's talking. So I'm gonna get Professor Joseph to respond to you. Thank you so much for the call.
Yeah. Well, I think that people want to talk about race, so I think Megan's right. I think that a lot of times people feel frustrated when we only talk about race in reaction against things like stop and frisk in New York City, or when New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says that Bill de Blasio, who is now the Democratic nominee for mayor, was running a racist campaign because he was putting his 15-year-old son, Dante, whose Afro has become a global phenomenon with its own Twitter hashtag. Because of that, he was appealing to ethnic appeal. And even though that's de Blasio's biological son and that's just his family, right? So part of where we're at right now is that we do not openly discuss race and racism in the United States. And this is a shame because racism in many ways has proliferated. Even though we have Barack Obama, Attorney General Eric Holder, Oprah Winfrey, and African-American luminaries.
Duval Patrick.
We have a talented 10th, and the 90% have been left behind in a robust, bold, rigorous way, systematically, not just in urban areas, but rural areas, not just in the Northeast and the West Coast, but in the South and the Midwest. And this is happening all around us. So even though we ended formal Jim Crow segregation, racism by another name, the outcomes continue to reverberate all around us. So what we need right now is an open and honest dialogue. And the people who have to lead that are American citizens themselves. This is what democracy looks like, and this is what we should be working towards.
Well, whether it's a small conversation or the large kickoff that you're beginning tonight, Professor Joseph, what we know is that people need a safe space to discuss these complex issues, and yours will be one tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. Peniel Joseph is a history professor at Tufts and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. And tonight at 7, he's hosting National Dialogue on Race Day. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll bring you an exclusive interview with Aria Weissman. For her, 9/11 means something completely different. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Researchers at UMass Medical School in Worcester announced they'd found a way to shut down the extra chromosome that causes the developmental problems of people with Down syndrome.
Higher education impacts everything from our economy to our ability to remain a world leader.
We were fortunate to get funding for high-risk, high-impact work.
Listen for reports from WGBH's Higher Education Desk on campus with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, family-owned and operated with over 60 locations across New England. From oil changes to computer diagnostics, their technicians are prepared to maintain your vehicle. Locations at sullivantire.com. And Massachusetts College of Art and Design youth programs offering classes for young artists grades 4 through 12, drawing, painting, animation, fashion, and more. You can visit youth programs at massart.edu/CE.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley here with Peter Katsas. We're filling in for Jim and Marjorie today, but you're about to hear from them. Yesterday, they recorded an interview with Aria Weissman. She remembers 9/11 as the day she lost her brother, Eric Weissman. He, along with Brendan Mess and Raphael Tekin, had their throats slashed on September 11, 2011. In the aftermath of the Boston bombing, Ibrahim Todashev implicated himself and Tamerlan Tsarnaev in this unsolved homicide. But while Todashev was being questioned about his role in the triple murder, he was fatally shot during an interrogation by an FBI agent. For the first time, Aria Weissman spoke about her brother's homicide with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The conversation begins with Aria Weissman describing her brother.
He was an amazing guy. He I give everything I know probably to him. He taught me so many things in life. I actually entered social work through him. He helped me get the job that I have now, and now I'm in my last year in grad school.
For social work?
Yes, so I give that to him for putting me through with that.
Why? Why was he the influence there?
Well, the influence was, I think, more so growing up in Cambridge, but I think I was having trouble. I got laid off from my job right after Obama got elected, and he, like, really worked hard to every connect he had in getting me a job. And I think the job that I have now is what paved the way for me to be able to get into school. So okay. I kind of feel like he gave that to me. I can only pray that, God forbid, when I pass away, as many people come forward as they have for him. I mean, there's been books and movies and songs and records dedicated to him, and people have come forward saying that they that he changed their lives and he encouraged them to go into their line of work. So
does it drive you nuts like it does me? I did not know your brother. I didn't know any of these three men. That essentially these three guys are murdered in an apartment in Waltham. Pretty gruesome murder. Couple of days of press coverage, and then until the authorities report a year and a half or whatever later that an alleged terrorist, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, at least up front, may be responsible. This totally fell off the face of the earth in terms of the media. What do you mean? Is that because you think the conventional wisdom is this is a drug-related kind of? Is that what you think it is?
Because, I mean, I've never even been asked a question about who he was as a person. So even when you are claiming that it got coverage, that was more so I don't know, like the logistics more on who they were and trying to capture that. That was not the kind of coverage that it was getting.
So the media, I mean, I've read virtually all the coverage from immediately after and then until it virtually disappeared again until the Tsarnaev thing. Was this, did you have the same feeling about law enforcement? Did they pursue this aggressively in your mind, or was this sort of, well, it's three drug deaths and we can't find anybody quickly, so we're just going to move on? What was your sense of that?
I think in the beginning, I felt that people were pretty much on the case and aggressive in trying to find an answer. And then I, too, kind of felt like it just faded off the map and got swept under the rug and it wasn't really getting coverage. And then all of a sudden, it was just like there wasn't even time to process the April 15th bombing before it was immediately implicated that there may have been a connection to my brother and these other two guys' murder. So, yeah,
we should mention the other guy. Is the other guy originally, almost immediately after the marathon, several days later, the contention is made that Tamerlan Tsarnaev may have been involved. And then a little bit later, when we hear about the FBI killing of Ibrahim Todashev in his apartment in Orlando, the allegation is made by the FBI that he was about to sign a statement implicating himself and Tamerlan Tsarnaev in the murder of your brother and those two other men.
But, all right, before we get to that, though, so your brother is killed. Two other young men are killed. Your family, your parents, your siblings, aunts and uncles are waiting for some answers. How did that did you guys call the cops and say what's going on? Or was there a victim witness advocate for your family? Or were you just kind of left hanging?
In the beginning, there were many, myself and the other family. I saw them a lot at the police station. We were asked to come in quite a bit. There were a lot of interviews and questioning going on. There was a victim's advocate who was reaching out to us quite frequent at the beginning, and more so lately, there hasn't been much movement.
Post April 18th or 19th, I don't know the exact date when there were first rumors that, not rumors, reports that Tamerlan Tsarnaev may have been involved in the murder of your brother and these two guys. Have law enforcement authorities at that point, did they immediately reach out to you and your family to update you on things, to bring you up to speed? Has that happened?
My family, and my understanding that some members of the other families or friends were the ones who contacted them.
Wait, contacted the law enforcement people?
Yes.
Meaning law enforcement did not contact the three families? The families reached out to law enforcement people?
I mean, they did reach out to us, but I remember at the beginning there was a Boston Globe article, I believe, that came out the Saturday after the bombing, and they had mentioned in the article the connection between Tamerlan and Brendan, and then it went viral from
Brendan
there.
Mess.
So I had people contacting me at that time saying, oh my God, have you heard the connection between them?
And people meaning real people, not
yes,
law enforcement
yeah.
people.
Friends.
Friends.
Did
yeah.
you ever meet Tamerlan Tsarnaev or Ibrahim Todashev?
No, nope,
do you believe, based on what you know, do you think they're responsible for your brother's murder, or do you think this is an attempt to just bring closure to this and sweep it under the rug?
I honestly think I do not have enough information to make a judgment call on that. My concern is that it is pinning the dead guy, and we're not getting much information on that.
I'm sorry to ask this again, but I'm actually fairly shocked. Since whatever day in mid-April Tamerlan Tsarnaev was first allegedly implicated in this murder, there has not been law authority outreach to you or your family on either at all or on a regular basis, bringing up, for example, we're told that the FBI was doing a DNA test on the body of Tamerlan Tsarnaev to see if his DNA matched any of the DNA in the Waltham apartment. Have you ever heard a word about that?
I heard that that was true.
From whom?
The victim's advocate. However, they were not able to give me a timeline of how long it will take for the DNA results to come back. And most of the other reports could not be confirmed or denied. So I'm kind of in the same boat as the rest of the world, even though this is
your brother,
my brother.
You know, this must have all struck you as odd that here you are, the your brother's killed, and then sort of nothing really happens. And even after the bombing, the link with Tsarnaev, there's been very little happening. What is this? What's your reaction to this?
It's disheartening. For whatever reason, it's actually kind of giving me more of a push in feeling more strong and searching for answers, especially as a social worker and working in a community where, I mean, this kind of stuff does happen on a regular basis, a murder and maybe drug correlation or what have you. Obviously a very different scenario, but it kind of makes me want to have a voice more for a lot of the people that probably go through this all the time. And I'm kind of shocked and stunned at how it's being handled myself. So,
but I guess the thing is, it's not like your brother was a member of a big cartel. I mean, yeah, this is, you know, weed.
That's
very,
all.
Very common. So he was, it was he treated differently because of this? You said before he was, which is pretty disheartening as well. That because he was selling some weed, he was not considered the right recipient of all the due process that you usually get in a case like this.
It seems that way. I feel like it almost got lost that these three guys were victims themselves. Like, I almost feel like that got lost, that they were not to blame, that they were victims in this. So, yeah, it is. I feel like it did kind of get pinpointed as drug-related, especially in all of the articles that were coming out and digging up anything they could find on any of these three guys. That, I mean, I have questions if this had anything to do with that to begin with.
And whether it was drug-related at all. Do you have a thesis as to what it might be?
Or? I don't, because this is so far-fetched and crazy. But, I mean, there's a lot of different kind of speculation that floats around the air, but I mean, it doesn't, in my right mind, it doesn't add up that this would be an end result of some drug deal gone bad type of a thing.
You know, you're talking about information and what you have and haven't gotten. After the FBI a report was, I believe, in the New York Times that in 150 shootings, the FBI had done internal investigations and cleared itself 150 out of 150 times. The Civil Liberties Union of both Massachusetts and Florida went to the attorneys general in those two states, obviously Martha Coakley here, and said, you should investigate what happened in that apartment with Todashev. Did he have a weapon? Was he about to sign a confession for the triple murder in Waltham? Martha Coakley refused to do that, even though there were two state troopers, Massachusetts state troopers. We don't know if they were in the room at the time, but they were in the apartment at some time. Are you troubled at all by that decision?
Completely. Very frustrated.
What do you think should be done?
I don't see why, if there are two Massachusetts state troopers that were in that apartment, in that room, what have you, why you wouldn't investigate in that. Why was Massachusetts in Florida to begin with then? Why are we not having answers as to why he was shot seven times? Why are we not having a clear story on if he was even holding a weapon, and if he was, why is there six different stories of what the weapon could
have
been?
Why do you think they don't? Why do they? But not only, I guess there are two parts. Why do you think they don't want all of us to know? And do you think they're not concerned that the three families end up finding out real answers to this?
Honestly,
do you think there's more going on?
Yes. I was going to say, honestly speaking, I don't think it takes a genius to realize that there's, I think, something a little bit bigger here. I don't really know what. I couldn't really answer that. But something doesn't seem completely legit here. I can understand why information wouldn't be released, as it is an open investigation and they don't want it to affect the investigation. But then it's frustrating that there's even anybody leaking information.
Well, but both of the alleged perpetrators are dead. It isn't like there's a due process thing. By the way, we're speaking to Aria Weissman. She's the sister of Eric Weissman, who's one of the three men killed in an apartment in Waltham on 9/11 2 years ago. If you could talk to the investigators who are taking a look at this now, whatever level they're in, what would you ask them? What would you want from them?
Oh, there's so many questions. I mean, I am very interested in knowing what happened to Todashev, because that's the closest, quote-unquote, confession we had to this murder. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Tamerlan thing is really just a mere connection that Brendan was friends with Tamerlan.
That's
a
without
coincidence.
Doubt. Yeah,
yes,
but
who knows if there's anything there. But for a supposed confession on the actual murder, I have a lot of questions on why they were investigating him in his apartment, why it wasn't being recorded, why they were even going there in the first place. I have questions of why the investigation is being refused and not being explained to the rest of the world, but also especially to the families.
If you were to get some answers and know what happened to your brother, and how would that help you and help your mom and dad?
for me, it's making a statement and hopefully some sort of a law change or attention from the rest of the world that the way things were handled wasn't really the way it should have been handled, and hopefully another family wouldn't have to go through the same kind of a experience. So
I'm going to appoint you the Queen of Laws of Massachusetts for one day. What's the one law change that you'd like to see happen right away?
Oh, God, I wish that police would have to take a sensitivity course. I wish they would have to. Certified, that they would know how to communicate with families and be sensitive to people who just lost people right away and asking questions. And I mean, I know they're doing a job and I thank them. I want them to do everything they can to figure out any crime that happens, but definitely wish that they would go through some kind of a sensitivity training.
Aria Weissman, we really appreciate your time. Thanks,
thank you.
Thank you.
That was Aria Weissman talking about her brother's unsolved homicide. When we come back, Christopher Lydon joins us for Open Mic. We'll take a forensic look at President Obama's foreign policy and ask if this is the man who his supporters voted into office. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Greater Boston, meet the candidates running for mayor of Boston. I'm Emily Rooney. Hear three candidates a night over four nights as they discuss pressing issues facing the city. Join us for these unique discussions with the candidates for mayor tonight at 7 on Greater Boston on WGBH2 and right here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and New England Audi dealers presenting the new 2013 Audi A8 TDI clean diesel model. You can learn more about Audi TDI clean diesel at newenglandaudidealers.com. That's newenglandaudidealers.com. And Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham. This active senior community in a natural setting offers something for everyone. You can find out what many seniors have already discovered at experiencenewbridge.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Peter Katz and I are filling in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan today. Christopher Lydon joins us in Studio 3 for Open Mic. Chris has been giving a lot of thought to President Obama's foreign policy, to Obama's handling of democracy. We're opening up the lines at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We really want to hear from people who voted for President Obama. Is this the man you voted for? Are you sticking by his side? Are you frustrated with him? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. So, Chris, where are you today on President Obama?
Well, I'm here eager to reframe this whole Syria story. It's still a full-blown crisis, but as I look at it, we're missing the lead here and the point. It's a tremendous democratic moment. I mean, the president, I'm talking about the bright side here. The president, 2 weeks ago today on this program, we were expecting the president to SWAT Syria within hours. The British Parliament said, no way, we're not doing it. And suddenly he was in a new mode. He said 2 weeks ago tomorrow, we're going to take this to Congress, which is where the Constitution says these decisions belong anyway. And since then, the war has ground steadily down. And this week, Vladimir Putin has offered a way out. I mean, this is a transformation, in my opinion. And
of who?
It's all,
of the president?
Well, of almost everything, Callie. Hmm. The American people have spoken in polls overwhelmingly to their congressional representatives. It may be 3-1 among people who actually care intensely and 2-1 among everybody. But they're saying, no, we don't want to go to war. Thank you very much. And the president is tiptoeing around the news, it seems to me, and the big media are too. But we've got a sturdy, very clear popular consensus now that missile and air attacks on Syria will not be good for the people who are suffering under that regime, and they will not be good for us. As I say, there is the Putin alternative, and it's a tiny minority out there that would stick with the line that, you know, peace through Russia is worse than you know, war through an American attack. We have something like a watershed here, I think, or potentially. First of all, and I give Obama huge credit for this, he has opened a national conversation, and people want to engage on it around war powers, on presidential authority, on intervention in general. And there's a consensus that we've never been told about before. Maybe we didn't know. I think this could be the end of this post-Cold War period of, shall we say, unipolar American thinking and doing. Blank check wars, no fault wars. I think it's the end of wars of choice and coalitions of the willing, especially after the British and even the French are saying, no, we're not in it. And the Pope's not in it. And the Secretary General of the UN isn't in it. And the EU isn't in it. We're out there alone. And President Obama is having to think twice. I mean, I sense a kind of reckoning, as we have not had since 9/11, for the Bush-Cheney view of ourselves. President Obama went along basically in Afghanistan and 2 weeks ago was ready to do it in Syria with a kind of, swat them first.
Well, but are you saying that, because a number of people have said we're happy that we are at this point now because we're not going to war, or at least imminently, but they're very unhappy with how we got here. I've heard
how we got to which? The pause or to the
attack? How President Obama got to this point of decision-making or not decision-making.
How did President Obama become a captive of the national security state?
this is so
fascinating.
Some
people have described the process of his getting there, by the way, as a Keystone Cop maneuver that felt like nobody's in charge there, that it's all over the place, and he sort of was backed into it now, not something that he directly wanted.
Well, there are these two theories. One theory, which gives him credit as a supreme chess player, would say that he seeded this reaction. He never really – he's not a belligerent sort of person. He didn't want a war in Syria, but he had to prepare for it, maneuver for it. But he incited, in effect, the reaction that has restrained him. In other words, he incited the people to say, no, don't do it, and give it a popular base. I think that's too clever by half. I think – I watched him Tuesday night, and I thought, no, this man is in serious danger of losing his way intellectually. That speech did not make sense, in my opinion. It was a stew of many cliches, like, you know, we don't want to gas babies, and we, you know, that's a horrific thing. Plus, but we're an exceptional nation. Plus, we have been the guardian of the world since World War II. Plus, you know, God loves us specially. We are, in fact, the effective United Nations enforcing values around the world. None of it added up.
Let's take a listen to President Obama actually speaking to some of the political forces, the Republicans and the Democrats, in his speech on Tuesday night.
To my friends on the right, I ask you to reconcile your commitment to America's military might with a failure to act when a cause is so plainly just. To my friends on the left, I ask you to reconcile your belief in freedom and dignity for all people with those images of children writhing in pain and going still on a cold hospital floor. For sometimes resolutions and statements of condemnation are simply not enough.
Was that the part that didn't make sense to you?
Well, it's one of many parts. And again, I think he framed it wrong. He's framing it in terms of political opposites, Republicans and Tea Party isolationists and liberal non-interventionists, this kind of thing. I think, in fact, and we've been talking about this for months now on this show, we're looking at a new convergence of the Rand Pauls of the world and the Mark Udalls of the world who, from different impulses, but not so different, are recoil from the predator drone USA will go anywhere, and they're getting together. In fact, I think it's a fascinating thing that this younger generation of people who've had enough of these foreign interventions are at a point of eclipsing the shall we say, the John Kerry, Hillary Clinton generation that were embarrassed by their votes for Iraq, never quite got themselves out of it, never articulated the lessons.
Well, why don't we bring Senator Rand Paul's voice into this? Oh, okay. And let me remind people that we're here with Chris Lydon. He's here for Open Mic, and we're talking about President Obama's handling of this foreign policy in light of the Syrian now non-war and the ongoing discussion about what it means for democracy. So here's Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's rebuttal to the president's speech on Tuesday night.
Americans, by a large majority, want nothing to do with the Syrian civil war. We fail to see a national security interest in a war between a leader who gasses his own citizens and Islamic rebels who are killing Christians. Some argue that American credibility is on the line, that because President Obama drew a red line with chemical weapons, America must act or lose credibility. I would argue that America's credibility does not reside in one man.
Peter, you wanted to say something before?
Frankly, listening to Ron Paul, Rand Paul, it changed my tack. What I find amazing here is that I think the American government, the government in Washington, the national security state, is having a nervous breakdown of sorts. And that nervous breakdown is rooted in the fact that no Western power, whether it be us, whether it be Russia, no Western power has any influence whatsoever anymore in the Middle East. There is a turmoil that I hesitate to call a revolution because a revolution's too neat a concept, but there is a fundamental upheaval taking place in the world of Islam, and the United States cannot affect it, and we can't get
Peter,
used to that.
Peter, I think you're really close to a big point here. I think the national security state is hugely embarrassed, and oddly enough, it's people like Rand Paul who are putting the needle most effectively. They're also demonstrating that national security establishment embraces John Kerry and Hillary Clinton, as well as John McCain and his Republican traditional sort of the war party sentiment. But so many things here. One hesitates to embrace Rand Paul for a lot of reasons. On the other hand, he keeps saying extraordinarily sensible things, including directly to John Kerry. Do you want to be the man who's going to send are you going to send the first man to die for a mistake? And highlighting that transformation of John Kerry's whole career. There he is out pleading for war on behalf of President Obama, who said, no, we don't do dumb wars. This was before Iraq. They're in a trap, I think. I think, you know, people wonder about what's going on in the American people. Is it war weariness? Maybe. On the other hand, I think you can feel a sort of surge of old-fashioned, dare I say, William Jamesian American pragmatism. We look at 40-plus years of war in the Middle East and say, to what end? What have we accomplished?
Well, it's a disaster. I was going to match him with another 19th century metaphor. I was going to say Whitman-esque common sense.
Yes.
Well, let's get some of the American people in on this conversation. David York from
Maine.
We're
all Americans. Come on.
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead, please, David York from York, Maine. Yes.
Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Yeah, look, I love the discussion, but I've not heard anybody take the view. And I think Chris started down this road when sounded like he was going to give President Obama some credit for moving this resolution that we're coming to now. But I see this as having been totally intentional every step of the way by the Obama administration. And some of the evidence is, first of all, that everyone was perplexed when the president said, I have the power to do this, but I'm going to ask Congress for it. And at the same time, he knew that he didn't have the support he needed Congress for it, but nonetheless, he was going to ask for it, and that was weird. The second thing is that John Kerry, who has been in Washington for how many years, 30 years? Who ran for president, who's the Secretary of State, who, if anybody in Washington, knows how to stay on message, somehow made an off-the-cuff remark that was seized on by the Russians within 3 hours and then seized on by the Syrians within an hour after that. It just seems to me that this has all been engineered very creatively. I don't know whether it was consulted by the Americans, but it's me we're getting the result that we want.
What do you think about that, Chris?
I think it's very interesting. This is the sort of Obama as chess player. Some people similarly, David, go back to his speech in Cairo in 2009. Some people give him credit for seeding the Arab Spring in a subtle sort of way. I think you can make an argument that he seeded the anti-war thing by going too far out for war. On the other hand, it seems to me it's the situation itself that is dominant, and it's a kind of huge house of cards that somehow collapsing. Obama is just watching it and going with the flow, or trying. I think he's still in trouble because he's still nominally, as he was Tuesday night, trying to sell a war.
David, did Chris get where you're going?
Well, yeah. I mean, he's selling a war, but he's selling it because he's playing one role in all of this, which is to bring the pressure to bear to make this happen. And what he's seeded in a way, which I think I really give him credit for, is sort of seeded the appearance that the Russians have taken the lead on this.
Well,
I think what he's getting is a resolution in Syria with regard to the use of chemical weapons that he wants. And it's a huge stockpile that they're hopefully going to get rid of. And I guess I would just draw the analogy, rather than back to the 19th century, to the 1960s, and say that, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis in large part was about missiles in Turkey.
Yes, it was.
And it was about missiles in Turkey that the Russians wanted to get rid of,
right,
the Soviets wanted to get rid of. And I think this is what we're doing. It is gamesmanship, and I think it is chess playing. And I think Obama and Kerry have operated brilliantly.
Let's hope you're right, and let's hope they keep doing it. I think, you know, history is a lot of it in direction and unforeseen, you know, unexpected consequences. I want to come back, though, to Peter's line about the sort of breakdown, the nervous or otherwise breakdown in the national security state. I mean, let's not forget the Snowden and the NSA background of this whole story, which was truly scandalous. The fact that the NSA can read all our mail and our phone calls and can bust...
And turns them over to Israel.
Yes, and, you know, busts every, you know, password in the universe, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a kind of grotesque exaggeration of this whole, not exaggeration, I mean, this is, what do I mean to say, cancerous growth of this thing, and people are beginning to say, what, and it all happens, but you notice in the last few stories on secret, you know, the
yes,
intelligence to Israel,
Snowden,
but also, yeah, you know, breaking your bank code, your every kind of code, these are credited now to St. Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks and these illegal modes of discovery, but suddenly the New York Times is banking on them like word from heaven, and even the Bradley Manning trial looks strange. What were they trying to keep secret? Why? We've never prosecuted anybody for the disaster in Iraq, and this poor devil is going to do the rest of his life in jail, maybe, for telling the truth about it. So I think there's, again, a moment where something huge is turning here.
Well, it is. When John Kennedy was assassinated, to try to clear up the mess, Lyndon Johnson appointed the Warren Commission. What we later learned was that the Warren Commission was, in a way, a massive cover-up for another phase of the national security state that was trying to assassinate Castro and destabilize regimes everywhere.
And keep the Cold War going that,
yeah,
Kennedy may have been, you know, about to end, as Ronald Reagan eventually did. I'm glad you mentioned that, Peter. I find myself thinking of the JFK and assassination anniversary very much as a piece of the end of an era here, or the rethinking of that whole era, especially if you, as you just suggest, think of JFK as, at bottom, a man who was profoundly experienced in war and deadly set against it, prepared to end the Cold War, even if he had to do it almost personally with Khrushchev.
Well,
eager to get out of Vietnam, eager to open up a modern dialogue with Castro. When you think that of that as the his assassination is the moment when the national security state seemed to, you know, take root.
Before we wrap up, let's take one more call. Lewis from Roxbury, go ahead, please. You're on 89.7.
Thank you. I'm very worried about the type of rhetoric that comes from people who never spent a day in uniform, are spending their lives in a battle, combat field, wanting to say that the president, you know, had to move towards war. I think this is the first time in 60 years of my life that I've seen a leader of this country use his mind and use the concern of what humanity is about to decide what should be done. And anybody who's criticizing that he's not pushing to have more people murdered in Syria, they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand the role that jihadists are playing in the so-called rebel groups. They clearly aren't working on the concept of humanity.
All right. Chris.
I was waiting for Peter.
Well, I was just going to make one.
Thanks, Lewis, for the call.
A previous caller mentioned the Bay of Pigs. Bay of Pigs was a disaster for John Kennedy, but it did him a favor. That's what he has. He suffered through. He saw through the national security state because they inflicted the Bay of Pigs on him. And Obama has never had that educational experience.
They did. You know, it's interesting. David Bromwich at Yale mentioned to me the other day, John Frankenheimer, the movie director of Manchurian Candidate, one of my favorite movies, asked John F. Kennedy if he could use the White House, the building, his office, to shoot 7 days in May about a military takeover. And Kennedy immediately said, yes, of course. I'll be away for the weekend. It's yours. And he said, you have to know that these people, the military, are crazy, and the American people have got to learn it and understand it. But what Bromwich, what fascinated Bromwich was that you cannot imagine those words coming out of the mouth of Barack Obama. I think Kennedy had reached a sort of more radical plateau of understanding the box he was in. Obama may be coming to it, but he's still in process.
All right. Well, that's the last word today on Open Mic. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Italian.
Chris Lydon joins us every Thursday at 1 for Open Mic. And when we come back, Jared Bowen tells us which mayoral candidate is best positioned to be the arts and culture mayor. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hi, this is Frank McClellan from L'Espalier. If it's your turn to cook tonight, how about serving up some of my delicious pot au feu? You'll love it. Your family will love it. And you can find the recipe online at wgbh.org/festival. That's also where you can pick up tickets to WGBH Food and Wine Festival later this month. Again, that's wgbh.org/festival.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Mass Mocha, presenting Fresh Grass, a 3-day festival of bluegrass and roots music, September 20th through the 22nd, featuring 25 bands, including Infamous String Dusters, Noam Pikelny, Sam Bush, and more. Freshgrass.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Peter Katzes and I are filling in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Earlier, we were talking about which mayoral candidate is positioned to be the education mayor. And now we're looking at who is best positioned to be the city's arts and culture mayor. Jared Bowen attended the Arts Forum earlier this week. And Jared, who impressed you most as a true champion of the arts?
Well, I don't know that I want to definitively say one. What I will say, I mean, first of all, this was the first time that there's been an arts forum like this. It was largely sponsored by Mass Creative, gathering the arts community. And I have to say, and I've seen some tweets about this, about the turnout, it was standing room only. And this was at the Paramount Center, right there on Washington Street in the heart of the theater district. And it began with Catherine Peterson from Arts Boston saying, this is why we're here. There are 10,000 full-time jobs created by the arts, and $1 billion, that's billion with a B, created in economic activity every single year. When you account for all of the arts organizations in this city, all of the revenue that they bring in through people coming into the city, passing through jobs and whatnot. So this is a huge economic engine. It's also frequently cited that the arts bring in more revenue than sports.
That's what I was just about to say. You stole my line.
I stole your line. You know, of course, this is something I observe on a daily basis. So it was fascinating fascinating to see most of the candidates show up for a forum hosted by Joyce Kilhawick. And I will point out those who did not attend were Dan Conley, Charles Yancey, and David Wyatt. And I talked with the organizers, and they told me they never got an explanation from any of those three why they didn't respond sooner to attend the forum. But I think everybody, in some measure, was on the same page. I mean, you had all of these candidates talking about, for one, they want to elevate the position of arts within city administration. Most said they would like to have a cabinet position created with an arts commissioner. Many said that they would like to see 1% of the budget in the city budget, a line item devoted specifically for the arts. And these are all people who recognize that this is going to be part of the city going forward. I mean, there has been some conversation back and forth about Mayor Menino's legacy, but going forward, the arts is going to be a driver.
You know, pardon me if I sound cynical, but Tom Menino, the current mayor, before he was elected, about 20 years ago, said almost the same things to me.
About the arts.
About the arts. Mm. I mean, it strikes me that the real test here is, when will Boston City Hall, like New York City, like Chicago, like San Francisco, when will they pony up taxpayer dollars? I'm a taxpayer in the city of Boston, by the way, if anyone's listening. I would rather see my tax money going to the arts than a lot of other things.
Well, I think what we also need to see here, and this is something that has absolutely really not happened to any great measure, is public-private partnership. Mm. I also am a big fan of Chicago. That is an amazing city. That is a hugely cultural city.
Isn't it great?
And we see it with Millennium Park that runs right along the lake there. And you see great examples of art.
I went there when they did the cows thing years ago. It was fabulous.
They were the first. I think they were the first city to do that, to do the public art installations. Mm-hmm. And then they have the digital images there. It walks right up to the Art Institute of Chicago. They have the Gehry-designed music pavilion. I mean, they have the Bean, the Anish Kapoor piece. You don't see that here in the city of Boston. And in Chicago, they were able to do it because they have public-private partnership. I mean, we're seeing it a little bit now. Just this morning, I was talking on radio about the new Greenway Carousel, which is designed by a Newburyport sculptor. You had one woman in particular step forward and give a lot of money for this. Tiffany stepped in to do all the surrounding landscaping that'll make it gorgeous. But by and large, you haven't seen not only the execution of this public-private partnership, but even an avenue to it. I mean, look at the rancor that was created when we were talking about the Greenway design.
Now, is that part of that have to do with the fact that we're so close to New York? Because sometimes theater companies and other arts experts and artists have felt like, you know, I'm doing really fine work here. And sometimes the shadow of New York doesn't inspire the kind of private-public partnership you're talking about.
I think that was true to some degree, but I think it's changed. I know in the theater community, you have a lot of actors who are staying here now because the theater scene has changed dramatically, and a lot of shows are going to Broadway from here in Boston. But you also have these new theater companies which are springing up and are really, really vibrant. And you have artists who I think are able to make a home here. And I have to point out, I mean, that's a good point, Kelly, because a lot of the candidates, Mike Ross in particular, Felix Arroyo, talked about how they want to put an emphasis on creating artist housing, which has been a huge issue here, especially as we see more and more development in Fort Point Channel and other areas.
South End, where all my favorite artists are getting squeezed out.
Well, exactly, because these were once areas that were fairly economically depressed, but now they're the hotspots.
Where I live in Jamaica Plain, artists who were, you know, moderately successful. I mean, they make their living as artists, not as waiters or waitresses. They're having trouble with their rents.
And I don't get, this is me riffing off, and I should have been at the forum to say this. I don't get why people don't get that when you have the housing with the artists all in there, it's exciting for the rest of us who can't draw or do anything else and who appreciate it. But let me get back to a point that was raised by candidate Bill Wozniak. He's been making this point, and I think it's one that ought to be articulated, and that is the impact on casinos. I think we have a clip from the forum, so I just want to hear what Bill had to say about this.
If there's one thing we absolutely have to do is we have to stop the casino in East Boston, because when casinos come into cities, what they do is they suck the lifeblood out of the arts community. They offer opportunities for different artists to be over there, and you know what happens with the casinos is they don't, once you go in, they don't want you to let you out. And so what happens is that in every city where a casino has been located, the arts community has suffered, including upwards of 50% lower revenue because of the fact that the casinos are driving business in that direction so that people will go there instead of to our local community artists.
Kelly, you began this discussion by trying to put me on the spot about who stood out. And I would say I think that Bill Walczak resonated with a lot of people. I had just quick conversations on my way out of the building that night. And a lot of – while everybody seemed to appreciate the passion for the arts that a lot of the candidates had, including claiming to be artists themselves, people, I think, were really responded to what Bill Walczak said, because not only has he incorporated the arts into his life and his business, he talked about how he's used the arts in the Codman Health Center, but he also went out on a limb to point out how casinos will suck the lifeblood, in his words, out of the arts community here. And I think that some of the arts leaders and the artists in the audience also saw a real leader here. It's one thing to be passionate about the arts. It's one thing to talk about it. Peter, as you were saying, Mayor Menino did a long time ago.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people saw in Bill Walczak a doer. And this is a huge concern for the arts community, because if you have another huge venue, because all of these casinos come in with a main stage where they can bring in high-end talent, depending on the size of the stage, they can bring in these big Broadway productions, that likely is going to take audiences out of the existing theater community and other performing arts.
Listen, before while this was still pending before the legislature, I had a discussion with Joe Spaulding, who was sounded like Bill Walczak today. No one would listen to him at the time, though. They thought it was Joe just, you know, bellyaching.
So because this forum was set in the context of economics and arts, will this area of interest get more attention in a serious way and not so much lip service?
I hope so. It's tough to see. It'll be interesting to see who carries what. I mean, this was a huge night for these candidates, too, because they were going from this arts event. And they, I have to say, just physically looking at them, they all looked pretty wary. And then they were, you know, about an hour later, they were walking next door to the Modern Theater to have the Neckin, the New England Cable News Boston Herald debate. So it was interesting to try to gauge where their interest truly was, because they were sort of lower key at the arts debate, but we saw a lot of fireworks, I think, at the Herald New England Cable News debate later. And I haven't seen too much traction about what people are how they're carrying it forward. I know Marty Walsh has a platform that he wants to explain. John Connolly has issued a pretty substantive plan. But that's all I've seen so far from these candidates.
All right. Well, I hope it stays on the agenda and prominent. That's just my personal thing. Thank you so much, Jared.
Thanks, guys.
Jared Bowen is WGBH's arts reporter and the host of Open Studio. When we come back, we look at who is working to make healthcare better. Kara Miller joins us for that conversation next on Boston Public Radio.
Twelve candidates are running for mayor of Boston. Who are they and what are their plans for the city? I'm Emily Rooney. All this week we meet the Boston mayoral candidates, three candidates over four nights. We'll get their take on the city's most pressing issues. Join us for a special Greater Boston tonight on WGBH2 and right here on 89.7 WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Welch & Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com. And Masterpiece, World War II may be over, but Christopher Foyle's war against injustice and wrongdoing rages on. All new episodes of Masterpiece's Foyle's War premiere Sunday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Peter Katzes and I are filling in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Well, we've heard a lot about what a mess our healthcare system is, but not so much on who is working to make it better. Kara Miller is here to shed some light on the doctors that are bringing medicine out of the dark ages and into the 21st century. Hi, Kara.
Hey, Callie and Peter. Nice to be here.
You have a particular focus on Dr. Eric Topol. It's a name that I had heard about before in my old days of being a health producer on ABC News. But he's really out there.
Yeah, he's a cardiologist out in the San Diego area, probably one of the best known cardiologists in the country. And one of the things he's really tried to do, you know, you look at our healthcare system, right? We all know it's a mess. We read things like, you know, an MRI costs $1,100 in the US, $300 in the Netherlands. You know, how do you deal with this? And one of the things that, that Dr. Topol says is it's really important to try to get to a point where we use the technology, like the apps on our iPhones and our iPads that are coming online every day to try to be healthier. I mean, that's sort of his idea is we need to destroy the way medicine is done now and have a sort of more technologically advanced, interactive way of dealing with it. I mean, you do interactive stuff with playing games, so why not manage your health?
And he really means it in the most fundamental and in some more complex ways. I mean, let me put on the table, though, that part of the whole Affordable Care Act is that all of these medical records, this is just a baseline,
yeah,
have to be documented and have to be electronic. So isn't that a step toward where he's going?
It is a step because, mm-hmm, you know, part of the way that, you know, Google figures out what you're interested in, right? Or Amazon figures out how to advertise to you versus me, is that they follow all the things you do, right? And if you don't have a database to work from, you can't figure out how you and I are any different, right?
Well,
and
this is the good side of metadata.
Yes, exactly. It's the good side of bringing together all that data. But I would say that Eric Topol's goes way beyond the idea of electronic medical records. So, for example, he has a little thing. Everybody knows EKGs, electrocardiograms, yeah, right? He has a little thing that attaches to his iPhone, and he can give you an EKG right on the spot. And he loves doing this because he goes in, talks to patients, and he can show them right then. Instead of, you know, the way it is now is you see a doctor, but then you go in for your test, but the person who gives you the test can't tell you anything. They say you have to talk to the doctor later, but generally that's on the phone, right? It's sort of all kind of disembodied, and there's these little parts of it. And he says, you know, I do it right then, and I show them, look, this is your heart. This is what things are looking like.
I had it, I hope this isn't maudlin for people, but my father, who died recently, almost 90, had a good life, but he suffered a stroke and a heart attack at the same time. And by the way, the EMTs gave great service, the doctors at the emergency room, but it took probably 45 minutes from where he collapsed at home to the time he was stabilized. And this article you gave Callie and I that explained how this little basically cell phone-like device, they could have known immediately.
Yeah. Well, Eric Topol was on a plane, right? And a guy was having a heart attack. And they said, is anybody a doctor here? He took his iPhone, put his little EKG thing on it, gave the guy an EKG right then and said, yep, he's having a heart attack. You're going to have to land the plane. That's what's happening here. And he was sort of immediately able to diagnose this. But this isn't just happening with the EKG. You think about all the streams of data that are starting to come from people. Think about people who wear the Nike Fuel Bands and the Fitbits, right? These are these little things. You may have seen people wearing these things that look like bracelets, right, from Nike. And what is it doing? Well, it's tracking how many calories they burn. It might be tracking their pulse.
How
many steps, your heart rate. There's ways
how you sleep at night.
Yep.
It'll show someone what a grossly unhealthy life I lead.
It'll bring all these streams of data, and I think the sleep one's really important because people have, for example, sleep apnea who do not know it. So you have people now generating tons of data. The data is synced with their smartphones. They're competing. I've met people. There's a gadget guru who we often have on Innovation Hub who competes with his wife to see, you know, how many steps they take and that kind of thing. Well, if that data is going to your wife, is going to your friends, and you're competing with them, why shouldn't that data be going to your doctor so that they're looking at the data and they're saying, well, gee, you know, it looks like your heart rate, your pulse, things, you may want to come in because they're looking a little strange to me. If you think about what it's like when you're in a hospital and, you know, when you're hooked up to monitors, the nurses can monitor that data from the nurse's station. They don't just go in and see you every 15 minutes. They go in when the data indicates they should go in. And in some ways, we have this very rigid system where if you're told, okay, you should go see a cardiologist, you may go in every 6 months, but maybe those aren't the dates. Maybe November 21st, which is the date you're about to see the cardiologist, maybe that's not a good date for you to go in. Maybe there's some other date a month before that when they should really see you before something happens.
So, Karen, we're speaking to Kara Miller of Innovation Hub about the subject matter of her upcoming program. Before I get to the issue of privacy,
yeah,
with some of the data that you've just mentioned, which always comes up as a part of this conversation, let me make clear that when we talk about Eric Topol, we're talking about somebody who is going up against a medical establishment that is really not well, I'm not saying they're not interested, but they're afraid or really quite resistant to what he has to say. And I just want to put on the table that anytime somebody like him is out there in front, well before this may become routine, he's really on a little island by himself. I'm recalling Dr. Barry Marshall when he came out and said, listen, ulcers are created by bacteria, not by stress. And everybody said, you are crazy. He ended up getting a Nobel Prize, but we move on from there. But for many, many years, he was a nut. So this is being resisted.
Right now. It's definitely an outlier. I mean, I think you've got a lot of things going on in the medical profession, and it's certainly not a monolith. I would say younger doctors are certainly much more likely to be open to the idea of, well, you know, we're going to do this using an iPhone app or everybody carry an iPad with them. That's how we're going to start diagnosing things now. So that's one thing. But there's no question when you talk to Dr. Topol, he does say it is very, very hard to convert doctors. I mean, they're used to doing things a certain way. They've been educated a certain way. And, you know, to say, oh, we've got all this new technology we want to teach you about. We may want to change the pay structure. This may also, remember, when you, instead of doing an EKG the traditional way, do one by attaching it to your iPhone, it changes the pay structure. And I also talked to John Gruber for the program that we have on Saturday, the economist at MIT, who is sort of one of the people responsible for what we call Obamacare and Romneycare. And he said, you know, it is very, very hard to transition doctors away from the sort of pay for service, pay for individual test way of doing things to something very different. And I mean, it will happen probably, but it's hard to transition people from this to that.
Is that because what I find when Callie was talking about how difficult it is for doctors in general to change, I began thinking, is that because they're so smart that they think they're smarter, you know, than their other fellow doctors? Or, I mean, to me, it just doesn't make sense. They're scientists. I mean, and I would think that the science would make it so clear to them. Well, but it sounds like sociology is trumping it all.
Let me just, before Kara answers, and say, don't forget there's the other side of this, too. Because they are scientists and they want to see some hard data around this stuff many, many times over before they make a move.
Yeah.
You can look to a case like the British doctor, whose name is escaping me right now, who insisted in a 1998 study that vaccines with measles and mumps were related to autism, period.
Oh,
and
right,
that was debunked.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, doctors and scientists have to say, wait a minute, before we make a huge move, make a change, which was why there was a resistance to Dr. Marshall saying, and his ulcer theory, not a theory, but what he realized was true, you know, they want a lot of data is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah. The other thing that happens, too, is doctors, unlike, let's say, somebody who is working in a chemistry lab their entire life, they don't have that much time to stay up on the medical literature. Doctors actually read very often, depends on the doctor, of course, but they don't spend their time reading the new medical literature all the time because they're working like all the time, right? That's not what they're doing, is that they're in academia and so they're reading all the journals. So I think one thing is also, it really depends on how the person is educated in medical school, and then they often stick with that. They sort of stick with that teaching through much of their career, unless
and
there's
to your
some
point,
big intervention.
Dr. Topol has tried to start an institute that looks at that teaches doctors in this new kind of methodology.
Yeah, and you know, he has said 90% of doctors say they don't really feel comfortable dealing with genomics, for example. So there's a company called 23andMe. I know people who've gotten their gene sequence using it. It's $99, actually. You can Google it.
And what does it do? I mean, if I were to have it, what would it tell me?
It would tell you all sorts of proclivities that you have. You know, do you have a proclivity towards lactose intolerance? Do you have a proclivity towards type 2 diabetes? All sorts of cardiac problems. And one thing that Dr. Topol really likes the idea of is finding these things out about people, so that it's sort of part of your data in general. And, you know, and certainly that could be entered in before you, that kind of data could be entered in before you ever walked in the doctor's office, so that the doctor, instead of going to the doctor's office and them giving you a clipboard and say, sit down and go do this, they already knew a lot of information about you. So there was sort of less information transfer going on at the doctor, which is a lot of what happens now. So they might look at your symptoms, but also know, well, looking at your genes, it looks pretty likely that what is happening to you is you have lactose intolerance, because it looks like it's in your genes. It's very likely that, you know, your parents had it, and that's funny.
I must add, as a former health producer, that they're looking at a little piece of your genome, that your genome is actually long and complicated. And some of the criticism about a 23andMe is that it's only looking at a little piece, and some other part of it could contradict that. Okay, continue.
No, well, having said that, I was going to say my teenage son, we were talking the other day, and he was saying, geez, Dad, I wonder if I'm lactose intolerant. I said, why? He said, well, just whenever I have milk or this. I mean, that's until Callie slapped me down before she knew what I was going to say. That's where I was going to go.
I just had to add that because
we're
talking about hard data and makes people be persuaded to change or not, right?
Well, I said, when you get all this data, does it change the kind of medications you prescribe? And I thought one of the really interesting things that he said, and I wonder if this is part of the vanguard of changes, he said, I have been prescribing not as much medicine as you would think. I'm prescribing a lot of apps. Like iPhone apps, right? To say, you know, you've got this problem. Can you track it? I'd like you to enter in what you're eating. I'd like to.
And nobody's upset about privacy issues?
Well, I mean, I think probably that you assume that your doctor is going to know all sorts of secret things about you, so that's okay. There's definitely questions when you get things on computers, on iPhones. Things are traveling, wirelessly. Clearly, there's a possibility that there will be privacy issues. But I have to say, when you also have pieces of information floating around about people on pieces of paper, there's privacy. But there's problems with privacy potentially there, too.
I would just say that maybe my pieces of paper are at the hospital, but his phone is at home, and maybe his wife is saying, oh, let's see what Kelly's.
What did he have for lunch today?
I mean, that's a real serious issue with all of this data, and we really don't have answers to that. But I would say, back to your story about your father, wouldn't you have rather had the information than not? I know a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
And you think about something like Facebook, where people willingly with very little gain to them, disclose things that are private. So I think people, if what they felt like they were getting in return was more health for themselves and their family, probably may not worry as much about it. But there's always that question of, is that data going to be used, let's say, by a healthcare company to think about whether they would not want to cover you because you're at a great risk for X, Y, or Z, right? All this data, right, can cut both ways.
Trust me, I'm already upset about Nordstrom putting up the thing on the side of my screen about the last bag that I looked at. You know what I mean? So this is kind of scary to me.
Yeah, I kind of like that because if I'm in the market for bags, then it's helpful.
All right. So Dr. Eric Topol and your other guest.
Yeah. And John Gruber this Saturday on Innovation Hub. And tonight we are talking with Guy Kawasaki about the future of technology.
All right. Kara Miller is the host of Innovation Hub. You can catch her tonight at 9 and Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock. Thank you so much, Kara.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley here with Peter Katzis. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan will be back tomorrow. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio.